All right, we're continuing the interview with David Lowell on September 16th, 1998. This is tape number 8. Spud Huestis.
Yes, Spud is died about 10 years ago. He was a high school graduate who was a promoter in Western Canada, and he had a very impressive talent for recognizing mineral prospects that might be potential mines. And at one time I tallied eight or ten mines that he was really responsible for developing. A fellow in Arizona who was president of Banner Mining Company, Alan Bowman, had a kind of a similar record. He was responsible for the company acquiring several major copper deposits, including Twin Buttes and Rosemont and one other whose name I forget, in southern Arizona, and one near Lordsburg, New Mexico. So the point of this is that it isn't as simple as getting a PhD in geology and leaving the university and saying, "Eureka, this is where we should drill for an ore body." In fact, an argument could be made that it's a handicap to have too much academic background. But getting back to my story, I had a drawing specialist that had earlier worked for Newmont and worked a total of something like 12 years for me, whose name was Bill Mounts. Name is Bill Mounts.
Yeah. What?
Mounts, M-O-U-N-T-S. And Bill is also a non-college graduate, but a very intelligent, observant, capable guy who does miracles with drill rigs.
Where is he based? Here in Tucson?
Well, he, for the past several years, has worked for Barrick Gold Company, and I'll mention him again when we talk about Purina.
Okay.
And he, early in his career, learned about drawing, working for Newmont at Carlin, Nevada, and then worked for me, and then he returned for several years to Newmont, and then to Barrick. The land work in connection with exploration projects is sometimes absolutely crucial to it's very blessed to figure out the geology and find an ore body, but it's more blessed still to acquire the ore body. And probably the majority of the major discoveries that that I've been involved with also involved some controversy or sometimes even lawsuits in connection with the ownership of the property. this was true, as I mentioned, at Kalamazoo and at VECO, effective negotiation with the Indians would have allowed the mine to be developed, and it, as it wasn't, at Escondida there was a long wrangle about ownership that involved a lawsuit after I was no longer involved in the project, and this also included the Zaldívar, nearby Zaldívar deposit, and the San Cristóbal deposit that we found and was later developed as a gold mine in Chile was more a triumph than signing up the property owners than geological work, I think. And the Leonora deposit in Chile revolved around ownership problem. So it's a consistent theme to have difficulty in acquiring title to.
Would you like to detail those problems now, or wait till you come to each one?
I'll talk about them when
each
we talk
one
about
in turn.
The exploration
okay.
projects.
Right.
But getting back to my exploration team, I part of my habit in doing exploration is to try to do it on a as low a budget as possible and as low a profile as possible and as small investment in secretaries and offices and vehicles and the window dressing that is commonly used in major company exploration. For example, right now I'm doing a project in a joint venture with Rio Tinto Mining Company, the former RTZ, largest mining company in the world. And we have two parallel programs in going on in Chile, and in our program we have two vehicles. Rio Tinto has 14, and we have a little office above a car rental place in Santiago, two-room office, and they have a palatial office in Santiago in two floors of a high-rise building, and another large office with 30 people in Antofagasta. And I've always felt that modest, small approach is really better, and it's better as nobody knows you're working and notices you. So I have always tried to put more than 50% of the budget into direct exploration drilling costs, and less than 50% into the everything else, including geologic mapping and head office and travel and infrastructure and so forth. And in Arizona for a long time, we were using 1.5 geologists, and I was the half who was working half-time on the project, and one drawing specialist, and one or two field assistants, samplers, and one secretary or one half-time secretary, and one part-time draftsman, and that was it. It was a pretty small, lean, mean organization, and we've done the same thing in other countries, in Chile and several similar projects in Peru, and our early project I had four senior Peruvian geologists working in the field, and we didn't have a full-time secretary, we didn't have an office, we didn't own a typewriter, and we didn't have a bank account. I was paying for things out of my hip pocket in Peru. And so it's a little different world, but
it obviously has succeeded.
Well, yes, through smartness or luckiness, it's a little difficult to be sure. But this half-time consulting, half-time contract work, I started doing this with Quintana in Arizona, and in 1973 I put together a program which we called the CAP, Covered Area Project, and it continued for about 5 years, but the intensive part lasted for 3 years, from 1973 to 1976. And you were asking if there was bad feelings from Newmont, and Newmont was the original funder of the CAP project about 8 years after the Kalamazoo discovery, so they obviously didn't feel too cross about it.
No.
And then Newmont originally signed the contract with me. Then they asked to bring in Hanna Mining Company to split the risk. And then a year later, Newmont essentially got totally out of the copper business, and they bowed out of our project, which was a copper project. As it happened, only a couple of months before the Casa Grande West discovery, which might have changed their mind if they... Mm-hmm.
This was here in Arizona.
In Arizona. And Hanna Mining Company brought in Getty Oil Company, and so the CAP was originally Newmont, then it was Newmont Hanna, and then it was Hanna Getty. And Getty paid their bills, but there is some question in my mind as to whether that was good luck or bad luck that they became involved in Arizona and later in Chile, because they were kind of a disorg somewhat in Arizona, and to a greater degree in the Atacama project in Chile. Getty had the same deficiency that Quintana had of almost total ignorance about the mining business, but the Getty people were basically intending to be friendly and kind and fair, and the head of the Getty exploration group was a fellow named Sig Musig, who probably had none of the characteristics that I listed as group characteristics for Quintana. And the result of this was that, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. I'll go back to the history of the CAP project. We had, at the time of the logic for the deposit was to use a more or less original mapping technique to project silicate alteration zones and geochemical anomalies in pre-mineral outcrop into post-mineral cover, and then drill scout holes on wide spacing to see if the alteration zone could be extrapolated. And the annual budget was $750,000, and we operated very cheaply and efficiently, I think. And we had drilled 20 prospects. I hope some of these people are going to leave messages.
I do too.
We had drilled we had in 2 years, 73, 74. Actually, it was 2 years from the time the contract was signed until the Casa Grande West project. We had drilled 20 targets, and we had drilled 120 individual drill holes. They were rotary drill holes at that time. And we had had one strong smell of mineralization, but no hits in the 20 project. The 21st project was the Casa Grande West project, and it was based on the fact that we were aware that Asarco's Sacatone ore body was bottomed on a flat fault, a large displacement, low dip angle fault, kind of along the lines of the San Manuel fault, but a flatter fault, almost horizontal. And we were aware of the fact that some mineralization had been found in scout drill holes in the Casa Grande Valley, and we were aware of the fact that farmers had, in quite a number of water wells in the valley, had found pebbles of oxide copper mineralization in the cuttings from the holes that were drilled as water wells. And this kind of refers back to my first article about mapping stream directions and sedimentary rock. And
excuse me for interrupting, but how do you become aware of these kinds of things? Did you check with water drillers?
Oh, it's through conversations with geologists with other companies. It's kind of through.
I'm just wondering where these conversations take place.
When you get together to have lunch or at geologic meetings or telephone calls and hi.
Hi.
Telephone's been ringing pretty steadily, but we haven't answered it.
You've been answering it right. Mm-hmm.
I guess so, yeah. Okay. And
you say you knew that there had been these things found in the Casa Grande Valley. I'm just wondering how you find out this sort of thing.
That's a good question, and our exploration at Casa Grande West was maybe the fourth round in that area, or the sixth round. It wasn't a new idea that there might be another piece of this ore body. Mm-hmm. And a number of other companies had worked there, and the typical habit of exploration geologists is after they try something themselves and it doesn't work, they chat with their friends mm-hmm. about it afterwards. And that's where the first part of the information came from. But I thought our project was kind of predicated on drilling scout holes. And we had a little project to compile all the information we could get on this area. And it was actually one of our earliest projects, the 20 previous projects that we drilled were the ones that at any given time we thought was the most favorable. And so this kept going to somewhere in the middle of the pile, but not being rejected. And we finally got around to the Casa Grande project, and we compiled all the information from Scuttlebutt and published information that we could get. And on that project, we even went so far as to go to the county recorder and develop a chronological history of when mining claims were staked and where and by whom in that area, so that we had a historical record of where Zarco's interest was, for instance, after they found that their ore body was bottomed by a fault. And Zarco was an individual company that was most interested in that target area and had done the most work there. Then I went back to my experience on the Colorado Plateau in mapping directions of ancient stream directions. And we had a program mapping along principally the east boundary of the, this is the Santa Cruz River drainage, but the Santa Cruz River kind of poops out and it goes into a distributary network, and it probably originally connected with the Gila River near Gila Bend, but doesn't now. It just kind of flows out into the valley there. And we mapped stream directions, and in the course of doing that, I talked to a friend whose name is Spade Cooley, who was a USGS geologist based in Tucson for a while. He no longer is. And I knew that he had worked in the vicinity of Casa Grande, and I compared notes on stream directions with him. And
this is current streams or ancient streams?
Ancient streams. Ancient streams. But ancient, but post-mineral. The age of the mineralization is approximately 60 million years old. And there are outcrops of rocks that range from modern streams to streams maybe 15 million years old in that district. And Spade told me something which was very surprising, and that was that his work suggested that the Santa Cruz River had reversed directions twice in its history, that it had originally flowed from south to north, and then it had flowed from north to south, and then it now flows from south to north again. And so I took this information and went back to our plotting of the locations where the copper pebbles had been found in the water wells, and which had not formed a very obvious pattern based on a south to north flow, but they made a very neat pattern, a cone, a wedge-shaped pattern on the basis of a flow from north to south. And so on this basis, we went out to the key area and acquired property, and some of the ground that we staked had originally been staked by ASARCO, and they had allowed their claims to lapse. And they later said, well, we were interested in this area all along, and you're just unethical latecomers and so on, but the evidence really didn't support that because they had allowed their ground to lapse. And so we went to this key area, and drilled several holes, and immediately found evidence of porphyry copper mineralization. The first hole intersected some leach capping, which is is the material over a porphyry copper deposit from which the copper has been leached and carried down to form a secondary enrichment blanket. And there was no, we found weak copper mineralization, but no strong mineralization. And we moved around then and the trail got hotter and colder and hotter. We were 6 miles from the nearest outcrop pre-mineral rock, so geologic mapping was of no use, but subsurface interpretation was what we were doing. And while we were doing this, the jungle telegraph operated in the opposite direction, and Asarco heard that we were drawing out there, and they got excited and came back out and started competing with us. And our fifth hole was near ore grade, and our seventh hole was definitely ore grade. And it became kind of apparent that one quarter section of land might be the center of the ore body, or of the, might be the center of available property. And this was land in which the surface owner owned both the surface rights and the mineral rights. And the owner was a congressman from Dallas, Texas, who had bought the land for speculation purposes, not for mineral, but for real estate. And
what was his name?
Don't remember. I may have that in my files, but we had borrowed Bill Mounts from Newmont Mining Company, and then he elected to resign from Newmont when they dropped out and worked for me. And we had borrowed a landman from Getty, whose name was Don Nichols. And Don Nichols was a retired Marine Corps fighter pilot, a very aggressive sort of guy.
You were just saying that he was an aggressive sort.
Yeah, Don Nichols was an aggressive landman, and most of his land work, I think, had been done in oil business, but he was a good negotiator, and we called this congressman, who was a kind of a self-important, successful politician, successful businessman, and he wouldn't talk to us. So I asked Don to make a trip to Dallas and go to see the congressman. He went to his office and explained to his secretary who he was and what he wanted to see Congressman Joe Blow about, and the secretary talked to the congressman, and the congressman said he was too busy to go away. So Don Nichols sat down in the chair in the office, and he waited there all day until this guy came out, and then he buttonholed him, and with his charm was able to talk to him and make a deal. So we got this quarter section of ground, which turned out to...
Did you actually buy it or just get the rights to it?
We bought it.
Bought it.
And it turned out to contain something like 500 million tons of 1% copper in one quarter of one square mile. We drilled through 1977, and my experience multiple times is that when some prize is found in a project like this, the major company develops almost irresistible urge to take the project over themselves. And so Hannah and Getty said, thanks very much, but we'll continue the development of it. And Hannah was the operator of the project, and they spent $20 million drilling at Casa Grande West, which was an excessive amount to spend. They drilled it out on too close spacing, trying to bend over backwards, being over conservative. And but what should have been done at an early stage was sink a shaft. The shallowest part of the ore body was 1,200 feet deep, and which is, would be an expensive shaft, but not they could probably have done that for not much more than $20 million, and they would have had the start of a mine. And instead of that, they drilled an excessive number of drill holes and were never able to make the hard decision to go underground on it. And this was partly because they were not a copper company and didn't have experience in this, and Getty was almost totally ignorant about mining. And the net result of this was that they sat around and agonized for years, and in the meantime, real estate development kind of encroached, and environmental movement became stronger and stronger, and it finally was no longer practical to try to develop a copper mine there. And the ore body may be lost forever as a result, and it's the most important discovery, copper discovery in Arizona in the last 30 years, probably. So that's the long, sad history of the Casa Grande West deposit.
So your contract was just to do the original.
Yeah, my contract said that a bonus would be paid when a mineable deposit was found, and we had a long argument about whether or not this was a mineable deposit. And it's kind of beauty is in the eye of the beholder. An aggressive company would have thought it was mineable, and a timid company would not. So they ended up paying part of the bonus payment in the country. I think if Newmont had still been involved in the project, and if they hadn't changed their policy about mining copper, they would probably have gone ahead and developed it.
This is the first time you've mentioned the environmentalists. Of course, they came really in 1970 is when they began to be a major influence in mining.
I guess that's right. I've never heard a date, but that...
Well, that's when the Environmental Protection Act
passed. That's an interesting comment.
I mean, the big force of the movement began in 1970.
Well, it has resulted in almost eliminating all mineral exploration in Arizona, which means that when the current mines are depleted, there won't be a mining industry in Arizona. So they have killed mining in Arizona and for the most part in the United States, and maybe that won't be important 20 years from now, but I suspect it may be important in the, from the viewpoint of the welfare of the country. There's a group in Tucson called the Southwest Center for Biologic Diversity, and it is its modus operation is to get money from Ted Turner and various foundations to file lawsuits, and they have active lawsuits against the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management and the university. They had a suit against the University of Arizona. They have prevented the construction of a high school in Tucson. They prevented the reopening of the Ajo mine by Phelps Dodge. In that instance, Phelps Dodge got all of their permits approved, and it was an old mining camp with minimal possibility for damaging the environment, and they were using environmental friendly concentration process. And they had to build a new high-tension power line from Gila Bend to Ajo within the easement of the existing power line. Mm-hmm. They got a permit from the Bureau of Land Management to do this, and there was something like a 120-day period for public input, and the Southwest Center for Environmental Diversity, or Biologic Diversity, 119 days and 23 hours later, in order to make it as difficult as possible for Phelps Dodge, filed a lawsuit to prohibit the construction of this power line, which it's hard to think could have caused any problem whatsoever. It's right beside the other power line. And shortly after that, Phelps Dodge announced that they weren't going to reopen Ajo, and this resulted in the loss of hundreds of jobs in the mine and in service jobs related to the mine. So this is how business is done. The head man for this Southwest Center's name is Suckling, and they were previously centered in Silver City, New Mexico, and Mr. Suckling was arrested for shoplifting and fined, maybe put in jail for a while, and so they moved from Silver City, and now Tucson is blessed with this group. The Forest Service has something like 30 lawsuits that have been filed against it. Maybe the majority by this group. And if I sound like a rabid anti-environmentalist, it's because I am.
It's a very difficult thing to work against or with, isn't it?
That's right. It's very stylish to to be in favor of clean air and clean mm-hmm. water, but I can't see how this is promoted by shooting down high school construction and all the other silly things that are being done. The Forest Service is really, as federal agencies go, quite a reasonably good organization, and they've been brought in Arizona to almost total halt by these lawsuits.
That's a shame.
Where are we?
I'm wondering if we have we reached a good stopping point, perhaps?
Yeah,
all right, we're continuing now after our lunch break. And we had finished talking about Casa Grande West, and now let's move on.
Well, I would like to backtrack a little bit to a project I had in Argentina in 1969 for Kaiser Aluminum Company. And
how did that come about?
Well, I think Kaiser contacted me pretty much out of the blue to do a porphyry copper reconnaissance of the Argentine side of the Andes.
Did you know anybody at Kaiser?
I knew Joe Durek, who had previously been chief geologist at the Morenci mine for Phelps Dodge in Arizona.
Derek?
Derek, D-E-R-E-K.
All right.
Mm-hmm. And this project lasted about 6 months, and I probably only spent 3 or 4 weeks of that time in Argentina. But I had a two-man crew working on the project. It was largely aerial reconnaissance, looking for alteration zones and following up on field trips. And the two people were Peter Davies, a Welshman who was working for Kaiser, a mining engineer, and Clark Arnold, a geologist who had previously worked for me in Arizona. And the first step in the project, which was a little bit self-serving on my part, was a reconnaissance flight from Lima, Peru to Santiago, Chile in a small plane, and with the object of overflying all of the known porphyry copper deposits and undeveloped prospects that I could learn about. And I did library research to locate all of the prospects that I could find any record of.
And what were some of them then?
Oh, they were all the southern Peru copper belt deposits, Cerro Verde, Cuajone, Quellaveco, Tocopala, and in Chile, Quebrada Blanca. At that time, the next one was Chuquicamata, and farther south, was El Salvador. And then Cerro Blanco, and at that time, El Teniente was called Braden, and there was a Disputada mine. And the trip began by chartering a twin-engined, fairly ancient small, I believe it was a Piper airplane, that was flown by a fellow named Capitan Perez, who was a moonlighting Peruvian army pilot. And we left the Lima airport and flying towards Arequipa and Tacna, Peru. And one of the engines went out on the airplane, mm-hmm. and we had to make a emergency landing at Pisco, Peru, and spent the night there, and got the airplane running the next day and flew down to Tacna, and went by automobile to Quellaveco and Tocopala. I think we did not visit Cuajone, but only overflew it. And we began to get emanations that we weren't going to be able to arrange a permit, as we'd been promised, to take the Peruvian airplane into Chile. There's a long-standing animosity between Peru and Chile going back to the War of the Pacific in 1876 or before and after, and we waited around for a couple of days in Tacna, and finally Capitan Perez and our airplane disappeared, and we were left in Tacna, and we got a taxi and rode in the taxi to Arica, Chile, and I was the best Spanish speaker of our group of two, and did most of the negotiating for us, and I inquired around Arica and was told that there was a Spanish immigrant to Chile who was a blacksmith in Arica, who was a pilot and would fly us in the Club Aéreo, the flying club airplane, and we talked to him, and he seemed like a impressive, intelligent, sensible guy, and so we made a deal with some trepidation, and it turned out very well. The airplane was almost new. The pilot was much better than the army pilot, and we flew from Arica, visiting some of the Quebrada Blanca and other prospects.
You actually landed and visited them?
Or? No, we overflew.
I see.
And we flew as far south as to overfly Chuquicamata, and then we turned west to Antofagasta and landed at Antofagasta. And, I called the Chuqui exploration office. Chuqui at that time was owned by Anaconda, and made a, in the meantime, they fixed base operator at the airport had told us that he would, without any doubt, be there at 7 o'clock to fuel the airplane. And so we got up early in the morning, drove to the airport in a taxi. We're waiting at 7 o'clock and no fuel man. 8 o'clock came and no fuel man. 8:30 so I called the Anaconda Exploration Office. These telephone calls were far from easy with in an isolated location and no way to pay for the easy way to pay for the calls and another language and so on. I finally got the secretary in the exploration office who spoke English, and I said, I'm terribly sorry and I'm upset, and this fellow was supposed to be here at 7 o'clock and it's almost 9, and she said, Mr. Lowell, is this your first trip to Chile? And we eventually got to Chuquicamata, had a nice visit, courtesy of Anaconda. Then I had written to Lou Gustafson, who was the chief geologist at Salvador, and had gotten no reply. So I assumed that we were not going to get a visit to Salvador, but we overflew Salvador and looked at it from the air, and then turned west again to Chañaral, a little town on the coast, and checked into the hotel, and by the time we got checked in, it was dark, and it was a little small hotel in a remote location, and the lights were poor in the hotel, and you couldn't see very well. And we ordered a scotch, and we're sitting there chatting, and a fellow walked up to me, and he said, "Are you Mr. Lowell?" I said yes, thinking there's no one in the world, not anybody, that knows that we should be in Chañaral. And he said, "Well, Mr. Gomez, or some name I've forgotten, wants to see you down at some place name, and if you could, if you can come with me, we'll go see Mr. Gomez." And I thought, what kind of a thing am I getting into? So I decided, what the heck, and got in the car and we drove down, and it turned out that the place we were going to was Anaconda's office in Chañaral, which was a kind of a port city for importing, not a city, it's only a village, but port for the Salvador mine. And Lou Gustafson had seen the airplane fly over and had deduced that from the letter that he hadn't answered that it was me. And so he'd sent this fellow to tell me if I'd come the next day we could get a mine tour. We flew on down looking at other prospects, and I took pictures and kind of studied the color zoning, which reflects the alteration zone. Finally got to Santiago, where we paid the charter pilot who had done a great job for us. One of the things we spotted in this flight was an Inca or pre-Inca temple on a high mountain peak, maybe at an elevation of 17 or 18,000 feet. And we then went from Santiago over to Buenos Aires and back to Mendoza to begin the project, which consisted of, as I mentioned, largely of aerial reconnaissance work. And
was Kaiser Aluminum wanting to get into Concord?
They said they were, but when they actually got their chance, they chickened out. The only prospect that came out of this program was Bajo Alumbrera, which was a couple of years ago acquired by Mount Isa Mines in a joint venture with Real Algum and I think North Mines is the other. Two of them are Australian companies. And
what was the name of the prospect?
Bajo Alumbrera, like shadowy low place. And I actually negotiated a deal with the entity that owned Bajo Alumbrera, came back at the end of the project with a deal signed by the Argentine government entity that was supposed to own it. And the Kaiser lawyer said that he doubted that these people had the authority to make the deal, and on that basis they were going to back out of the deal. But it's a large copper gold ore body. Whether it would have been profitable to mine at that time, I don't know. It was barely identified and certainly not drilled out.
How was Kaiser to deal with?
Kaiser was, aside from welching on buying the mine, were fine to deal with. I later did some work for them in Iran also. And I have pleasant recollections of, personal recollections of the Kaiser people. We had some kind of wild experiences in the reconnaissance flying. We ran into the same problem as with the Peruvian airplane, that the aircraft maintenance was in general poor in Argentina, and some of the pilots were not well trained, and we were doing high altitude flying without oxygen, and sometimes flew as high as 18,500 feet, and which is a little bit dangerous for the observer, but it's very dangerous with respect to the pilot controlling the airplane. And the I remember on at least one occasion we're having mechanical problems with the airplane, and a ambulance raced down the airstrip beside the airplane.
Just to say.